Chapter 48. Not even in jest. What you have done has been done of your own choice, because you thought it best for your people. My nearness or absence could have made no difference. He looked at her with growing wonder. Why this sudden modesty? He said with a smile. I thought you prided yourself on your share in the great work. She tried to force an answering smile, but the curve broke into a quiver of distress, and she came close to him, with a gesture that seemed to take flight from herself. Don't say it, don't say it, she broke out. What right have they to call it my doing? I but stood aside, and watched you and gloried in you. Is there any guilt to a woman in that? She clung to him a moment, hiding her face in his breast. He loosened her arms gently, that he might draw back and look at her. Fulvia, he asked, what ails you? You are not yourself tonight. Has anything happened to distress you? Have you been annoyed or alarmed in any way? It is not possible, he broke off, that Tresker has been here. She drew away, flushed and protesting. And no, no, she exclaimed. Why should Tresker come here? Why should you fancy that anyone has been here? I am excited, I know, I talk idly, but it is because I have been thinking too long of these things. Of what things? Of what people say. How can one help hearing that? I sometimes fancy that the more withdrawn one lives, the more distinctly one hears the outer noises. But why should you heed the outer noises? You have never done so before. Perhaps I was wrong not to do so before. Perhaps I should have listened sooner. Perhaps others have seen understood sooner than I. Oh, the thought is intolerable. She moved a pace or two away, and then, regaining the mastery of her lips and eyes, turned to him with a show of calmness. Your heart was never in this charter, she began. Fulvia, he cried protestingly, but she lifted a silencing hand. Ah, I have seen it, I have felt it, but I was never willing to own that you were right. My pride in you blinded me, I suppose. I could not bear to dream any fate for you but the greatest. I saw you always leading events, rather than waiting on them. But true greatness lies in the man, not in his actions. Compromise, delay, renunciation, these may be as heroic as conflict. A woman's vision is so narrow that I did not see this at first. You have always told me that I looked only at one side of the question. But I see the other side now. I see that you were right. Odo stood silent. He had followed her with growing wonder. A volt face, so little in keeping with her mental habits, immediately struck him as a feint. Yet so strangely did it accord with his own secret reluctances, that these inclined him to let it pass unquestioned. Some instinctive loyalty to his past checked the temptation. I am not sure that I understand you, he said slowly. Have you lost faith in the ideas we have worked for? She hesitated, and he saw the struggle beneath her surface calmness. No, no, she exclaimed quickly, I have not lost faith in them, in me, then. She smiled with a disarming sadness. That would be so much simpler, she murmured. What do you mean, then, he urged. We must understand each other. He paused, and measured his words out slowly. Do you think it a mistake to proclaim the Constitution tomorrow? Again her face was full of shadowy contradictions. I entreat you not to proclaim it tomorrow, she said in a low voice. Odo felt the blood drum in his ears. Was not this the word for which he had waited? But still some deeper instinct held him back, warning him, as it seemed, that to fall below his purpose at such a juncture was the only measurable failure. He must know more before he yielded, see deeper into her heart and his, and each moment brought the clearer conviction that there was more to know and see. This is unlike you, Fulvia, he said. Why, you cannot make such a request on impulse. You must have a reason. She smiled. Why, you told me once that a woman's reasons are only impulses in men's clothes. But he was not to be diverted by this thrust. I shall think so now, he said, unless you can give me some better account of yours. She was silent, and he pressed on with a persistency for which he himself could hardly account. Colin, you must have a reason for this request.
I have one, she said, dropping her attempts at evasion.
And it is, she paused again, with a look of appeal against which he had to stiffen himself.
I do not believe the time has come, she said at length.
You think the people are not ready for the Constitution? She answered with an effort, Colin, I think the people are not ready for it.
He fell silent, and they sat facing each other, but with eyes apart.
You have received this impression from Gamba, from Andre and I, from the members of our party, he asked.
She made no reply.
Remember, Fulvia, he went on almost sternly, that this is the end for which we have worked together all these years, the end for which we renounced each other, and went forth in our youth, you to exile, and I to an unwilling sovereignty. It was because we loved this cause better than ourselves, that we had strength to give up for it our personal hopes of happiness. If we betray the cause from any merely personal motive, we shall have fallen below our earlier selves.
He waited again, but she was still silent.
See, can you swear to me, he went on, that no such motive influences you now? That you honestly believe we have been deceived and mistaken? That our years of faith and labor have been wasted, and that, if mankind is to be helped, it is to be in other ways, and by other efforts than ours?
He stood before her accusingly, almost, the passion of the long fight surging up in him as he felt the weapon drop from his hand.
Fulvia had sat motionless under his appeal, but as he paused she rose with an impulsive gesture.
Oh, why do you torment me with questions, she cried, half sobbing.
I venture to counsel a delay, and you arraign me, as though I stood at the day of judgment.
It is our day of judgment, he retorted.
It is the day on which life confronts us with our own actions, and we must justify them, or own ourselves deluded.
He went up to her, and caught her hands entreatingly.
Fulvia, he said, I too have doubted, wavered, and if you will give me one honest reason, that is worthy of us both, she broke from him to hide her weeping.
Our reasons.
Reasons. She stammered.
What does the heart know of reasons?
I ask a favor the first I ever asked of you, and you answer it, by haggling with me for reasons.
Something in her voice and gesture was like a lightning flash over a dark landscape.
In an instant he saw the pit at his feet.
Someone has been with you.
Those words were not yours, he cried.
She rallied instantly.
That is a pretext for not heeding them, she returned.
The lightning glared again.
He stepped close and faced her.
The Duchess has been here, he said.
She dropped into a chair, and hid her face from him.
A wave of anger mounted from his heart, choking back his words and filling his brain with its fumes.
But as it subsided he felt himself suddenly cool, firm, adamant.
There could be no wavering, no self-questioning now.
When did this happen, he asked.
She shook her head despairingly.
Fulvia, he said, if you will not speak I will speak for you.
I can guess what arguments were used, what threats, even.
Were there threats?
Burst from him in a fresh leap of anger.
She raised her head slowly.
Threats would not have mattered, she said.
But your fears were played on, your fears for my safety?
Fulvia, answer me, he insisted.
She rose suddenly, and laid her arms about his shoulders, with a gesture half tender, half maternal.
Oh, she said, why will you torture me?
I have borne much for our love's sake, and would have borne this too in silence, like the rest, but to speak of it is to relieve it, and my strength fails me.
He held her hands fast, keeping his eyes on hers.
And no, he said, for your strength never failed you, when there was any call on it, and our whole past calls on it now.
Rouse yourself, Fulvia. Look life in the face.
You were told there might be troubles tomorrow, that I was in danger, perhaps?
There was worse, she shuddered.
Worse? The blame was laid on me, the responsibility.
Your love for me, my power over you, were accused.
The people hate me, they hate you for loving me.
Oh, I have destroyed you. she cried. Odo felt a slow, cold strength pouring into all his veins. It was as though his enemies, in thinking to mix a mortal poison, had rendered him invulnerable. He bent over her with great gentleness. "Fulvia, this is madness," he said. "A moment's thought must show you what passions are here at work. Can you not rise above such fears? No one can judge between us but ourselves. Ah, but you do not know, you will not understand. Your life may be in danger," she cried. "I have been told that before," he said contemptuously. "It is a common trick of the political game." "This is no trick," she exclaimed. I was made to see, to understand, and I swear to you that the danger is real. And what if it were? Is the church to have all the martyrs?" said he gaily. "See, come, Fulvia, shake off such fancies. My life is as safe as yours. At worst there may be a little hissing to be faced. That is easy enough compared to facing one's own doubts. And I have no doubts now, that is all past, thank heaven. I see the road straight before me, as straight as when you showed it to me once before, years ago, in the inn parlor at Peshiera. You pointed the way to it then. Surely you would not hold me back from it now?" He took her in his arms, and kissed her lips to silence. "When we meet tomorrow," he said, releasing her, "it will be as teacher and pupil, you in your doctor's gown and I a learner at your feet. Put your old faith in me into your argument, and we shall have all Pianura converted." He hastened away through the dim gardens, carrying a boy's heart in his breast. 4.10. The University of Pianura was lodged in the ancient Signoria town hall of the Free City. And here, on the afternoon of the Duke's birthday, the civic dignitaries and the leading men of the learned professions had assembled to see the doctorate conferred on the Signorina Fulvia Vivaldi, and on several less conspicuous candidates of the other sex. The city was again in gala dress. Early that morning the new constitution had been proclaimed, with much firing of cannon and display of official fireworks. But even these great news, and their attendant manifestations, had failed to enliven the populace, who, instead of filling the streets with their usual stir, hung massed at certain points, as though curiously waiting on events. There are few sights more ominous than that of a crowd thus observing itself, watching in inconscient suspense for the unknown crisis which its own passions have engendered. It was known that His Highness, after the public banquet at the palace, was to proceed in state to the university, and the throng was thick about the palace gates and in the streets betwixt it and the Signoria. Here the square was close packed, and every window choked with gazers, as the Duke's coach came in sight, escorted meagerly by his equerries and the half-dozen light horse that preceded him. The small escort, and the marked absence of military display, perhaps disappointed the splendor-loving crowd, and from this cause or another, scarce a cheer was heard as His Highness descended from his coach, and walked up the steps to the porch of ancient carved stone, where the faculty awaited him. The hall was already filled with students and graduates, and with the guests of the university. Through this grave assemblage the Duke passed up to the row of armchairs beneath the dais at the farther end of the room. Tresker, who was to have attended His Highness, had excused himself on the plea of indisposition, and only a few gentlemen in waiting accompanied the Duke, but in the brown half-light of the old Gothic hall their glittering uniforms contrasted brilliantly with the black gowns of the students, and the sober broadcloth of the learned professions. A discreet murmur of enthusiasm rose at their approach, mounting almost to a cheer as the Duke bowed, before taking his seat, for the audience represented the class most in sympathy with his policy, and most confident of its success. The meetings of the faculty were held in the great council chamber, where the rectors of the old Free City had assembled, and such a setting was regarded as peculiarly appropriate to the present occasion. The fact was alluded to, with much wealth of historical and mythological analogy, by the president, who opened the ceremonies with a polysyllabic Latin oration, in which the Duke was compared to Apollo, Hercules, and Jason, as well as to the flower of sublunary heroes. This feat of rhetoric over, the candidates were called on to advance, and receive their degrees. The men came first, profiting by the momentary advantage of sex, but clearly aware of its inability to confer even momentary importance in the eyes of the impatient audience. A pause followed, and then Fulvia appeared. Against the red-robed faculty at the back of the dais, she stood tall and slender in her black cap and gown. The high windows of painted glass shed a paleness on her face, but her carriage was light and assured as she advanced to the president and knelt to receive her degree. The parchment was placed in her hand, the furred hood laid on her shoulders. Then, after another flourish of Gutenberg edition, end of chapter.